Professor Moshe Capel of the Computer Science Department of Bar-Ilan University conducts research on a variety of machine learning applications, including speaker recognition and automated game playing. He is best known for his contributions to the branch of text categorization concerned with authorship attribution. Professor Capel is invited to comment on today's seminar.
Thank you. Okay. First of all, thank you, David, for the initiative, and thank you very much for inviting me to participate. Thanks to Heshi and Bencion for hosting and organizing. Great pleasure to be here. Thank you also to all the speakers who were fantastic. I have 10 minutes to talk about six speakers. You guys get to talk about Rav Soloveitchik. I have to talk about you. Because the time is somewhat limited, I'm going to speak in generalities about what was common to all of you rather than and only obliquely address each of you individually, mainly raising some questions. Let me start with a heretical question. Everybody kind of, the touchstone of everybody's talk here was the last line of the Rav's halachic mind: out of the sources of halacha, a worldview awaits formulation. It behooves us to ask a question: is there such a thing as a worldview? Does halacha determine a unique worldview? If there is such a thing, do we actually want one? If we wanted one, would we know how to formulate one? Nobody addressed these things, but they're all difficult questions, and it is by no means obvious that the answer to any of these questions is yes. And let me explain why this is difficult. I want to distinguish between two ways of thinking about a worldview. First of all, yeah, it seems obvious that everybody has a worldview. Nobody's got a view from nowhere, right? Everybody's view is from somewhere. So in that sense, everybody has a worldview. But clearly the Rav was not talking about the kind of worldview that is implicit from us living in a particular way and therefore having an implicit worldview. He wants us to actively formulate a worldview. That means a worldview of which we are conscious, not an unconscious worldview. To make this perfectly clear, if we were to describe how a bird flies, we would use differential equations, okay? So birds are essentially solving differential equations when they fly, but they don't actually solve differential equations. If a bird ever tried to solve differential equations, if it depended on that in order to fly, it would crash and burn, okay? Similarly, bats use sonar in order to not crash into the walls of the dark caves in which they fly. They use echolocation, okay? But bats actually know nothing about sonar despite the fact that they're using it. But since I don't know what it's like to be a bat, let's take something a lot closer to home, okay? We speak language, okay? We implicitly know the rules of grammar when we speak our native language, but we're not conscious of these rules of grammar. If you ever started to study linguistics and think about and study the actual rules of grammar that you yourself use in your native language, you'd go out of your mind, okay? They would not look familiar to you at all, okay? So we have a worldview in exactly that sense. It's implicit in the way we live. A person who lives according to halacha and who is immersed in the study of halacha will have an implicit worldview. But can we make that worldview explicit? Can we actually formulate it? This isn't obvious at all, and it's not obvious that it's even a good thing to do. I would also add that it's not obvious that it's unique. That if we actually tried to formulate it, what kind of worldview might we arrive at? I think if some people who live according to halacha and who study halacha come to the conclusion that the human condition is characterized by lowliness, shiflus ha'adam, right, nevadik, right? Others who are learning exactly the same Gemara, exactly the same halacha, living by exactly the same halacha, except their entails, what the worldview that they formulate, kind of implicitly and only slightly explicitly, is the grandeur of man, godless adam, right? And, you know, one or two briskers who are living in Berlin conclude, well, man has a dual nature and can inevitably only reach existential angst as a result of this dual nature, okay? So people could be learning and living by the same halakha and nevertheless be reaching very different implicit worldviews. As for explicit worldviews, it only gets worse. But let's assume, okay, let me assume the basic assumption of this entire seminar, which is that in fact it is possible and desirable to formulate a worldview out of halakha. Okay, fine, there's a problem there. The problem is as follows. Everybody quoted Hume already, all right? We discussed Hume on induction and Hume on empiricism. I'm going to talk about Hume and the category error of confusing is and ought, okay? Whatever you might think about a worldview, it might be mostly just kind of an abstraction of ought, of how what we ought to do, but in some very, very generalized way. But I think inevitably a worldview is going to encompass some aspect of is. It's the point is to tell us something about the way the world works, okay? Now, Hume points out that there is a jump between is and ought. You can't get from an is to an ought, right? And all of moral philosophy in the past two centuries has been, okay, fine, you can't get directly from an is to an ought, but suppose we had some kind of a bridging axiom, right? Some axiom that said something like, right? We know how the world is, and now we have some axiom that says, oh, by the way, you should never do an act that has property X, or you should always do an act that has property Y, right? And basically what moral philosophy is about since Hume is, let's plug that gap. Let's define the X that you should always do, the property of an act that you should always do or never do. And, you know, for some it's, you should always do an act that maximizes aggregate utility. And for others is, you should always do an act that you would want to have everybody do, categorical imperative, right? Or you should only do things that you would have others do to you, right? The golden mean. Or if you're an Aristotelian, you should only do things that actually perfect character, right? So there are all kinds of ways for bridging the gap between is and ought. But note that all of these are going in one direction. We're assuming that we start with an is, and now we want to figure out what the ought is, how we should live our lives, right? Now, the challenge that the Rav presented over here, out of halacha, which is a system of oughts, right? It's a normative system. What we ought to do, a worldview awaits formulation. What the Rav is telling us is, let's see how we can get an is out of an ought, okay? And that's a difficult thing to do, getting an is from an ought. As a matter of fact, it's harder to get is from ought than it is ought from is, and I'll tell you why, for one simple reason. Okay, when if I derive an ought from an is, I say, this is how the world is. Now let me tell you what people ought to do, right? Well, you could never prove me wrong, right? Well, I just stated that this is what people ought to do. Okay, go. What are you going to say to that? Okay. But if you try to get from an ought to is, this is the halachic system, and right now I'm going to tell you how the world actually works. Well, I might tell you how the world actually works and be proved wrong, all right? And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. But the point is that to get this bridging axiom that we need to get from an ought to an is, that is to formulate a worldview out of halacha, right? It's got to look something like, well, it must be that halacha is optimizing something, right? Halacha is making the world a better place, right? Or it's making the Jews better people. Or it somehow reflects reality in some way. And by using this mapping, right, we're going to figure out what is. We're going to formulate a worldview. Now, basically, all six speakers were essentially addressing this question. How can we get an is from an ought? How can we get from this halachic system to an understanding of how the world actually works. But I have to point out, without blaming anybody for anything here or pinning it, there are two pitfalls in trying to do this, two potential pitfalls, right? One of them is that we escape to abstraction, okay? To abstraction that's so abstract that it loses all affective meaning, all right? So, for example, the easy way out is to say, yes, you know, there is this world of halacha, and there's some other completely theoretical world, some conceptual world, where you know, when you do mitzvahs and averas in this world, well, you're kind of pulling the strings up in that theoretical world, you know, it's a metaphysical world. So it might be, you know, in the world of the Sfirot, if you're into Kabbalah, or in some other theoretical world, if you're Reb Chaim Volozhiner, where, you know, there's a parallel universe to our universe, right? One against one. Or you might run away to kind of the foundations of mathematics, right? Where, well, it's all kind of vague anyway. So we're going to say vague things about the foundations of mathematics, and no harm is done, okay? So that's one danger, okay? But there's another danger. The other danger is we actually get, that's too abstract. The other danger is we get too concrete. We actually say, you know what, we want halacha is a certain way, and we know that halacha reflects the world, or rather that the world reflects halacha, right? And we want to actually learn things about the world from halacha. So let me give you an example of where this can go badly awry, okay? The Noda B'Yehuda, who is the source of the Chazon Ishir, right, for eggs and so forth, it all comes from the Noda B'Yehuda. What happened? The Noda B'Yehuda used as a, you know, he measured the standard length measure of fingers and the volume measure of eggs, and he saw that they didn't match, right? He knew that there were certain measures that were given both in terms of cubic fingers and in terms of eggs, and they didn't actually match according to his finger and his eggs, okay? So he said, look, there were two possibilities. Either the eggs used to be bigger, or people's hands used to be smaller, right? Now he says, you know, we have this general principle in halacha that the further we get from Har Sinai, from the Misora, the more corrupted things get, right? Niskatnu adoras, right? So the Noda B'Yehuda comes to the obvious conclusion, right? That since niskatnu adoras, right? Well, since the real world is merely a metaphor for halacha, therefore it must be that in fact people's hands have gotten smaller. It can't be possible, right? That eggs have gotten smaller. It can't be that eggs have actually, that people's hands have gotten bigger, because we know that in the halachic world, people are actually getting smaller, not bigger, okay? So this is an example of where you try to formulate a worldview out of halacha by turning reality into a metaphor for halacha, and you end up in a really bad place, which is actually verifiably false, okay? So we have this problem. You don't want to get too abstract, and you don't want to get too concrete. The question is there a middle ground? And the answer is, I think there's clearly a middle ground, and it was alluded to by several of you. Let me get more precise about it. You spoke about time, you spoke about causation, you spoke about intention, okay? Well, maybe if we actually study Misasek and Shogeg in a serious way, we could understand Chazal's view of intentionality with a T. If we study Brera in a very, very serious way, we might get to Chazal's ideas about the flow of time. If we study Grumma and Garmi, right, indirect action in damages, and when you're chayv, when you're putter, right, when you have to pay damages and when you don't, well, we might learn something about Chazal's worldview of causation. All this is sufficiently general that it's not easy to falsify. It's falsifiable in principle, but it's not easy to falsify because it's sufficiently grandiose. On the other hand, it's sufficiently concrete that it's about the real world and actually has some affective meaning. So I think some of you are a little bit too abstract in all this, if you'll forgive me. I think we need to get a tad more concrete in order to get a sense of what the Rav really meant about formulating a worldview out of the sources of Allah. Thanks.
Thank you, Moshe Kapel.